remember in terms of the agenda of the Education Team, we have invited the legal team of Parliament to come and brief us on the bill.
Greetings to you, Chairperson, and to all the honorable members and everybody in the house. Thank you, Chairperson, for the introduction. And my name is Shumelele Ngema, parliamentary legal advisor. I'm going to try and take you through the three bills as Chairperson has indicated. All these bills were actually introduced last year, but because we are all aware of the committee work that was dealt with last year, it is only that we will start processing these three bills in 2017. But they are all bills from 2016, as you can see. That one which I will start with, the Liquor Product Amendment Bill, is Bill 10 of 2016, which means it was introduced last year already, but the committee is starting to process them this year. And just as a summary for all the three bills, as I'm going to be addressing all three of them, they are all amendment bills, which means there is an existing legislation that they are seeking to either correct in some manner or to add whatever the department that has felt it needs to be edified, or there was a vacuum or whatever it could have been. So basically, the Liquor Product Amendment Bill is amending the Liquor Product Act, number 60 of 1989. And just as a way of general consideration, because the first point we need to start at is the point where we're supposed to check the bill so that the JPM can make a finding as to what process must have been followed. When this bill was introduced, the state law advisors had advised the department that it should be a Section 75 bill. And in this instance, we are also in agreement with the state law advisors and the department in proposing that this bill should be addressed or should be processed as a Section 75 bill. And just as a way of background as to why we are saying that, upon considering the bill, the whole provisions of the bill, we ascertained that there is no specific schedule, functional area that is mentioned in Schedule 4, where it indicates that this bill should specifically fall under that subject matter. And so, from looking at the Constitution, it gives us the direction as to how bills must be processed by the national legislature. We found that it is a bill that falls within the mandate of Section 44(1) of the Constitution, which enables or gives Parliament the power to legislate on any matter that is not listed on any of the scheduled matters. One of the main things that the bill seeks to do is to provide definitions and provide requirements in respect of the liquor products that are purposely intended to fall into the market for trade purposes. So the bill, as well as the principal act, it does define what wine is, which are the liquor products that the act deals with, as well as the amendment will touch on some of the few of those mentioned liquor products, which are wine, any alcoholic food beverage, a spirit, a drink-based liquor, especially authorized liquor, and any liquor than a product mentioned here in respect of which a certificate has been issued. So for anything to fall under the definition or fall within the ambit of liquor product, it must be defined and required to have a certificate in terms of those things. Now, the purpose of the Liquor Product Amendment Bill is seek to redefine certain definitions in the Principal Act, as I had indicated. Now, for our purposes and having considered the provisions of the clause, we thought it's essential that the committee, when it starts considering the bill,
the legal guru says it seeks to redefine. But what is written here is not quite sure written. Which is which?
Thank you, Honorable Member. Basically, after I had sent the presentation, then when we read this, we see certain things that need just minor corrections there and there. But basically, there is both a redefinition of the existing definitions and the definitions of other definitions where they felt that they must bring better clarity. So, for purposes of this bill and for purposes of questions that perhaps need further clarity, the definitions that the portfolio committee should consider significantly are the definitions of beer as liquor product, and because beer now they have said it must include traditional African beer and other fermented beverages. There is a definition and there is also a requirement that for purposes if you want to trade on traditional African beer, this is how it should be made. So the provisions, which I will also outline when we get into the content of the bill, that we must specifically focus on, especially and engage with the department. As I said, it's the beer, traditional African beer, and the other fermented beverages. The final point that the purpose of the bill seeks to do is, I suppose after they did their research and investigation, the department found that there are certain aspects of the Principal Act that must be repealed. And so that is also what this bill seeks to do. As I said, because the bill mentions something that others would assume or would have a view that it relates to tradition, to customs, or in any way customary law or indigenous law, especially because there is a reference to traditional beer or traditional African beer, as it was initially called in the Principal Act, or what we would know as Ngomboti and other names. So we thought we need to look at Section 18 of the Traditional Leadership Framework Act, which basically requires that if a bill deals with anything that has to do with traditions or traditional law or indigenous law or customary law, that must be referred to the National House of Traditional Leaders by the Secretary to Parliament and give them 30 days to consider and make input on the bill so that those inputs can come back to the committee. But in respect of checking the provisions, because Section 18 says the content of the bill must pertain to customs or customary law or traditional law or tradition. Looking at the bill, as I indicated on the purpose and the content of the specific provisions, which is clause 5 of the bill, it basically, and it is specifically, I think, 6B. Which sets out the requirements for the African traditional beer. Looking at that provision, it says nothing that relates to customs or changes customs or repeal in terms of customary law, how people were doing things. It only brings the requirements that the minister would require compliance for purposes in case this kind of beer is going to be put in the market for purposes of economic whatever or purposes of a person wanting to trade in the African traditional beer. Therefore, it has nothing to do with what the terms of Section 18 of the Traditional Leadership Framework Act is providing and requiring. And therefore, in our view, together with the view of the state law advisors that also prepared an opinion on this bill. It is not a bill that falls within the ambit of Section 18 of the Traditional Legal Framework. As I said, this is an amendment bill, and most of the provisions are straightforward. So the ones that I pointed out and we are discussing today, it's just a few that I thought maybe there are points to highlight for purposes of the committee to look into properly and then consider in significant measure, especially when the briefing and the deliberations with the department are taking place. The next one is clause 10. And clause 10, they are amending section 18 of the Principal Act. And what basically is proposed by the amendment is to relate for purposes of compliance, because as the Act is already in place, it must be properly implemented by the department, and it must also be fully complied with by those who are using it and working within the sphere of this legislation. So in this regard, Section 18, they are proposing that it be amended in its subsection 1 with the provisions that deal with the issue of entry, seizure, and confiscating of whatever goods that they find are not in compliance with the provisions of the Act or the regulation. So what happens in the proposal is that they are basically making some changes to say that the officers that are mentioned in that section, they are being empowered to enter into the premises, whether it be a private dwelling or it be premises where they are conducting business for purposes of this Act. Now the issue, considering that now we have a constitutional dispensation, we have to ensure that whatever is provided in the legislation, since the Constitution is the supreme law and has plotted the way to do things, we have to consider whether the way they've drafted this provision, does it comply with the provision of the Constitution which says everyone has the right to their dignity being protected. And when we've got judgments and different number of cases, we have spoken to the very same issue to say that the privacy, especially in private dwelling of people, must be given significant protection and consideration, even through any legislative measure. But if you look at the amendment of Section 18 there, it says Section 18 of the Principal Act, that is clause 10, is hereby amended, and I'll just read A. The administering officer and an officer acting under a delegation or direction of the administering officer, the things that are in brackets will come out, and then they want those that they've underlined to come in. So I would read the way that the bill should read once it's processed and corrected. So the administering officer may, in the exercising or carrying out by him or her of any power or duty which is granted to or imposed upon the administering officer by or under this Act, at any reasonable time and without prior notice, enter upon any place, premises, or conveyance. Basically, what this preceding words before they list out what you may enter and do, it gives them, it enables the administering officers or any officers that are delegated to ensure compliance with the law, that at any reasonable time and without prior notice to the owner of the dwelling, whether it's business or private dwelling, they may enter the premises, but there are sub-provisions that they've included there to try and ensure the abuse of power as well as taking the power that those people that would be entering the premises to a point that they abuse the people that are in there to a point that there is a breach to the right of privacy and the right of dignity. But the provisions that they've provided, for instance, in Roman Figure 1, they're saying, including a private dwelling, you can only enter in a private dwelling whether it's the consent of the owner or the person in charge of the place or the premises or the conveyance. Roman Figure 2, you can only enter the premises excluding a private dwelling from which a person conducts or is on reasonable grounds suspected of business falling under the provisions of this Act or a scheme. And you can enter the dwelling, which is a private dwelling, under authority of a warrant issued in terms of paragraph B or without a warrant in terms of paragraph B. So basically, with these three provisions, they've added them so as to ensure that there is constitutional compliance, because these are providing the protection that the Constitution requires for both the people that must ensure that there is compliance with the Act and for people that must comply with the Act itself. So in this specific provision, and looking at its entirety, including what the principal Act in Section 18 says, we felt that it is constitutional and they've drafted it properly. And the next point on this bill, as I said, fortunately, I'm not yet sure how the committee will process them, but they are not complicated bills like the previous ones with address. They are straightforward, simple, and straight to the point. They are very clear. The last point, which is only for purposes of drafting, I think the department, when they take through the bill before the committee, it was asked what they've done in terms of the schedule. There is a reference to an act that is already repealed, and they are indicating as to what needs to happen and what was. So with this, as I said, it's a consideration just for drafting purposes, whether they meant really reference to a repealed act, which was repealed by Act 59 of 2003 already, but they are making reference to it here, especially in relation to the beer, fermented spirit, as well as traditional African beer. But as I said, it's more on the definitions and to make clarity of the bill. That is all that is basically in relation to the liquor product amendment here. And as I said, it's a straightforward thing. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, that was the presentation on the liquor product amendment bill. Any questions or clarity? This is just the first written by our legal team. We still don't have staff to come in and present this bill and engage with the staff. That is the second thing. They were what just called our lawyer to come and give us the context of the deal that we are doing. If we are going to interact with that, we then have that understanding that the deal is in place. Honorable Sultan. Honorable Mayor.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for the presentation. My concern about this is about the certification. I'm not sure if that is a point of emphasis in this context, especially with regard to traditional beer, because it's made in different ways from area to area. Now, who is going to have or think that they have got the authority to certify for people in the Gulf or for people in Cape Town, for people in Eastern Cape? Now, I haven't read through the whole thing, claim. So if what I'm asking about is very succinctly explained elsewhere, please bear with me. But I suspect that certification and who will set the standards and based on what? Because I guess if you're going to certify something, there must have been an agreement on the standards of production and so on. I don't think the matter needs any further explanation here, but that's where I am a little bit concerned. Thanks.
My question is based on an assumption that the legal advisors of Parliament, their key responsibility is to advise Parliament, and in this instance, it will be a portfolio committee. one, if there are areas which the portfolio committee needs to focus on and advise the portfolio committee on those issues. Now, the only question I want to pose to the presenter, are you saying to us, firstly, that the tagging is correct? Because you are saying you have looked into all these things and you are satisfied with the tagging. Secondly, are you saying that they have, having gone through the principal bill, including the amendment, that it is constitutional? And are you saying to us that it is not necessary for us to refer it to the House of Traditional Leaders because it does not address issues of customs, tradition, and so on and so forth, despite the fact that it talks about traditional beer? And are you happy that what you want the committee to do is just one thing, to look at the definition and nothing else? Is that what you are advising this committee to do? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Members, for the questions. With regards to the first question as to who will take the responsibility of certifying the process of the African traditional beer, if you look at clause five, which basically seeks to inject section 6B into the principal bill, that is the provision that sets out that in respect of the African traditional beer, what will be the minister looking for as a requirement that that kind of beer can be the African traditional beer that is enabled to go to the market for purposes of trade. So there is already a clear criteria as to what it is that they require and how it must be done and how it must be cemented, and as well as the measurement and all that. But as I said, this has nothing to do with respect to how each nation does its own African beer or whatever process you follow, when it's for purposes of culture or it's for purposes of whatever event within the customary law or within the traditional framework of people. It is only on the basis, if you look at the Principal Act, because the Liquor Product Act's main purpose, it was to ensure that for trade purposes, whatever forms of liquor, they are in compliance with the uniform standards that the country, in terms of the policy, it has set. Because there is a liquor product policy that sets out the requirements of all the liquor products that must come to the market in this country as well as internationally. So the certification process and the requirements are set out in the main Principal Act as well as in this bill. It has brought in further clarification in respect of the specific ones that they felt were either having a shortcoming or were not clearly outlined. And that is in relation of the first question. In respect of the second question, Honourable Member, indeed you are correct. The notion of desirability and the constitutionality of the bill is now at the hands of the committee, because that is exactly what the committee is basically doing. What I've indicated is to say that in terms of the process, when the bill is introduced, the joint taking mechanism, which is called the JTM, must make a finding so that it already provides a direction as to how the committees of parliament must address or process the proposed legislation that is before them. And in terms of the standing process, when the bill is introduced, the minister, together with the assistance of the state or advisors, they make a proposal which basically, through their engagement, indicates that we are thinking, and from our own consideration and legal view, we feel that this issue should be dealt with following either 75 or 76. In this instance, they indicated that they propose that it be a 75 bill. And there is a process and a criteria that we follow, which is outlined especially in section 76, as well as some constitutional court judgments that have assisted in order to deal with many of the problems, because as I indicated in the previous bills we dealt with, this is a very complicated process. You need to consider a number of things. So in terms of that, and the advice that we provided to the joint pegging mechanism, we also advise them that we are in agreement with the view of the state law advisors to say that this bill must be processed under Section 75. So this one, the Liquor Products Amendment, for what it seeks to address, it will be processed under Section 75. And again, in terms of looking at what Section 18 of the Traditional Leadership Framework Act provides, because that is the provision that provides us the terms of restriction in terms of what exactly needs to be done in matters that relate to traditional issues. In this instance, as we have said, the bill does not seek to change the manner that people are doing their traditional years for whatever purpose. But in this instance, for purposes of protecting the country and protecting the people themselves, and if you are going to place your products for marketing purposes and for trade purposes, the department, in terms of the policy on liquor products, they have set a standard that should be a uniform standard for that purpose that is followed by any person who wants to enter the terrain of marketing traditional beer and any other liquor product that must come into the market. So that is why, in our view, and in all considerations that we have done, it is not looking at the provisions themselves. They are not the provisions that fall within the ambit of Section 18 of the Traditional Framework Act, which says any bill that pertains to customs or traditional law, it must be referred to the traditional leader's house. It basically tells, informs of the requirements that are necessary to ensure that the standards set by the policy are met, and not to change anything that pertains to custom or customary law. That answers the two questions in terms of the referral as well as the tagging questions that were raised and the issue of desirability. And then the bill does not only deal with definitions, but what I said as mentioning those products was to basically say, in terms of what this bill focuses on, these are the specific provisions. And the definitions that I have mentioned, it's not only them that the bill deals with, but it's what the gist of the bill. As I said, there is a principal act in place, but the bill seeks to focus on just a certain mainstream provision, which have are already indicated. And the department, when it comes to bring their briefing, they will indicate as to what was the, what prompted them to change these provisions into what they are now suggesting, because we are not privy to that information. But for us, it was just to alert the committee that there is something like this, and these are the salient or standing out positions that the committee needs to look into. But when the bill is brought by the department, and when they do the briefing, certain issues may arise which may want us to look into the constitutionality of the bill and look into other things, because certain other things arise as when the experts and the people that are practicalizing the bill and implementing it, they know. But basically, on the content as it stands and the requirements from the Constitution, what we are saying in terms of what is before the committee and what the committee must process, so far, things are looking in order with the Constitution, especially on the salient features of the bill. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. We pretty much appreciate the comprehensive explanation given by our legal advisor. And it has actually prompted me to put this view across. One, this should not be a Section 75 bill. It deals a lot with tradition. If we treat it as a section, otherwise as a Section 75, we are almost ignoring the fact that South Africa has got different traditions with different areas. That's number one. And I'm not sure if our constitutional that will be effectively, because there will be just one standard set by the national minister. Secondly, the you know, agriculture as such is a concurrent function. Provinces need to be able to pronounce on this. And why take them out in this instance on something that they should be given an opportunity to express themselves, you know, as a matter. And lastly, how would this would have the effect of cutting out anything that does not meet the requirements of the minister? Would have no name brands, and who can guess what would be the commercial as well as the social, that is, and the health effects of something that does not fall within the ambit of the definition as desired by the bill to be implemented by the minister. If it doesn't comply with this, then what is the name of that product? And yet, effectively, it is a traditional beer for people in the Popo, for people in KZN, for people in the Eastern Cape. And so for those three reasons, you know, I would like for us, you know, to have a relook at the proposed approach to this bill.
I think that is a discussion that must be further as we are coming to discuss, because I have got a different view of the debate. So let's not enter into the debate now. Honorable Sapa, Honorable
Deposition.
Thank you, Chair. I hope I'm not also pushing you into the debate, I'll ask you to pardon me for my ignorance in this case, because I was just wanted to get it. I am comfortable with the explanations, but I'm just asking for a comfort to get that while this explanation is for the beer or the liquor for marketing, is there somewhere else where it is covered for liquor that is not for marketing, but it is for consumption by human beings, which might also be a concern of the government. Thank you.
Thank you very much, No, I just want to check. There is what is known as remote that is being sold by people from the small business people. So I want to check if perhaps, because this has got to take some time, 1 or 2 days. I don't know whether that could be regarded as information. But now, how would you know that it is not legal? Someone is going to check perhaps this, and it is being sold, that it's not legal, it's not part of this. Can't we be cheated perhaps? Unless now there should be a license for those people now who are selling this, you know, dishes made from the meat and from, what is Amazon as well?
So
come here, yes, a combination of that. So we will be regarded as these other things. Thank you very much.
When we are going to debate, that's where we look at the provisions that this, the amendment is bringing to us, whether we are satisfied that in terms of the control that the department wanted to put into how much alcohol must go into this beverage or spirituous, whatever. We are sure, we are correctly agreeing that if there is a tightened processes at all levels, whether this bill regulates only for the market. The issue of drinking at home as a part of custom and other things is a health issue. Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Honorable Maloy.
Chair, you know the question I posed earlier about was trying to suggest that legal advisor from Parliament is not their responsibility to
make a presentation and convince us as to why it is necessary to make this amendment and start to engage. Their responsibility is to advise us as to whether what we are doing is on track, is constitutional, they've looked at it and so on. They are satisfied that the committee can take a certain direction. And based on that, I was going to propose that we should close it here, because I think they told us what is their opinion as a legal advisor, that it's going to take it and so on and so forth. But just to emphasize one point, it is also not the responsibility of a portfolio committee to decide on a taking of a bill, whether it's section 74, 75, 76 and so on. It's a responsibility of a joint taking and so on. If they get locked there, there are dispute resolution, whatever, that they have as to how to resolve this thing. For now, I'm going to propose that we have heard what they've said and so on. Let's wait for the department to come and present. While they present, they will then engage. Because I have many issues which I want to raise on this thing, but I don't think that I must raise them with the legal advisor. But I must raise those with the department. Thanks, Chair.
Tell the department, you have to restructure this and or change this section so that it complies with the rules of parliament, with the constitution of South Africa. So thank you very much. We'll now go to the second bill as National Forestry Amendment Bill. And happy Valentine's Day.
Okay, thank you.
So I propose that it's a Valentine's Day.
Thank you, Chairperson. Have just on that one to say that on the question that asked whether there is other legislation that addresses certain issues on alcohol and other things, yes, there is, Chairperson, the Liquor Act as well as the Liquor Products Act. And the other act then that stems from the Liquor Act, the Liquor Policy. But moving on to the National Forest Amendment Bill, as I also indicated in my introduction, this one as well, it seeks to amend an existing principal act, which is called the National Forest Act of 1998. In this instance, the bill was proposed to be facilitated or dealt with as a section 75. But upon our engagement with the bill, as well as the other stakeholders, including the state law advisors and the advisors to the speaker, as well as the chairperson of the NCOP, we found that there are some different views in terms of the tagging process and having looked at the content of the bill itself. Because generally speaking, as the main act is about national forest, which includes indigenous forest, and in terms of the definitions that they are also providing here and what they seek to do, there is an involvement of indigenous forests and how they should be administered or whatever they want to provide. So having looked at the process of tagging and what its purpose and what it seeks to achieve, which basically the court and looking at Section 76, which is the main one that looks into the issue of tagging, what the court have told us that a bill that must fall within Section 76 is a bill that in substantial measure is going to impact on provinces. And in this instance, if it's not only that, but if it's also a matter that falls within a specific area that is listed in Schedule 4, it goes without question then that you can't even look into whether it substantially impacts on the provinces or it does not. For the fact that it is falling within a concurrent matter, because the concurrent legislative competence matter, it means even the provinces on their own, they can legislate on it. So if, as the national parliament, the national legislature, for whatever purposes that, because also in terms of the general mandate of what parliament can legislate on, as earlier on I referred to Section 44, there is a provision that says parliament may legislate on any matter. Then there are specific provisions then that outlines and set out what it is that must be a restriction or that must be considered before parliament takes on that mandate as provided for in the constitution. So in this instance, differing from the view of the state law advisors as well as perhaps the department, because once it's introduced, that is the proposed position by the minister. We felt that, and in advising the JPM, we felt that there are, in fact, listed areas under Schedule 4, which looks at the administration of indigenous forests, nature conservation, and environment, as well as generally the management of forests. That falls within the environment as well as agriculture. So looking at some specific provisions, as I've mentioned, like clause 1, 2, and 4 of the bill, or in entirety, the provisions of the bill, there is definitely provision, or what the bill seeks to do is to address issues on the management of forests in a broader measure. Hence, in our view, we are saying that this bill is a bill that deals with matters that are listed under Schedule 4. And if you look at Section 76(3) of the Constitution, it is clear for any matter that the bill and its content seek to address a functional area that is under Schedule 4, it automatically must be the Section 76. And this is what we advised on the JTM, and the JTM also has made its finding and the decision to say this bill will be processed for the Section 76 bill. Again, in terms of process-wise, for purposes of Section 18 as well as the traditional leadership framework, as I said, this section requires that if there are provisions in the bill that deals with matters that pertain to customary law or customs, it must then go to the House of Traditional Leaders. In this instance, we are required to look at the content of the provision, scrutinize it, break it down, and look at the end result that it seeks to achieve or what it is that it wants to legislate on. And then you must, from your legal view, make a stand whether the wording of the content of the provision, it falls within the ambit of the terms of Section 18 of the Traditional Leadership Framework. But it is very clear. It says the provisions of the bill must pertain to tradition, customs, indigenous law, or customary law. In other words, as they try to explain it in the Constitutional Court judgment, for instance, when the Dongwane judgment was dealing with the communal lands issue, they said, for an example, where the bill wants to repeal or change how traditionally things are done, That would be a bill that relates to traditional law or to customs. And if it speaks to into the customs of people, then that would definitely be a bill that falls within the ambit of Section 18. But if it's just for the, for instance, as this one does, it seeks to say, this is how indigenous forests must be protected or whatever the bill says. It doesn't say whatever indigenous people are doing with indigenous forests or the use of indigenous products that come from the indigenous forest. It doesn't seek to legislate on that, and therefore we agreed with the view of the minister as well as that of the state law advisors to say, if looking at the content of the bill, this is not the bill that falls within the Section 18 of Traditional Leadership Framework Act, and therefore it is not necessary in terms of this act that the Secretary to Parliament must refer the bill to the Traditional Leadership House. And then again, the provisions that we are sticking to on the bill, as I said, it does not say in this presentation the other ones that are not mentioned are disregarded. As the chairperson has indicated, it was for the purpose to zoom into those that have obvious concerns or obvious queries that must be clarified. But each and every provision of the bill, as before the Portfolio Committee, it must be scrutinized, it must be considered, it must be interrogated. But the ones that we have basically zoomed into, as I said, they have salient things that stand out. And in this instance, I also look at Clause 8, which is the amendment of Section 17 of the Principal Act. In this provision, it's a provision that allows the minister to declare certain forests as controlled forest areas. So either they have found that that forest is undergoing some form of deforestation, or there are some steps that have picked up that that forest, in order for it to survive and not be extinguished, it must be rehabilitated. So Section 17 in the existing provision of the Principal Act already set out a process and mandates the minister to actually do that power to declare controlled forest areas. But whatever they seek to do in this instance, they are adding Section 13 and Section 14 into a subsection to Section 17 of the Principal Act. Now, what they've done in terms of the two additional provisions, the ESA provisions that I've mentioned, subsection 13, which is the additional one that they want to bring in, they are seeking to find power to empower the minister to declare these controlled forest areas without consultation or without affording a hearing for those that will be affected by the decision of the minister. And in this regard, we have to consider, because we already have existing laws that speak to not having to do an arbitrary administrative action. And this, in this instance, we then look at the promotion of administrative action, the CADRA Act. What Section 13 does is to enable, I mean subsection 13 of Section 17 of the Principal Act, as I said, it enables the minister in the listed circumstances to declare without the consultation or without affording a hearing to those that may be affected. However, if you take it further than to 14, it does seek to address the concerns that subsection is raising. And for purposes of clarity and taking you through with me, sub-13 of Section 17, as they seek to introduce it, they are saying the minister may declare a controlled forest area, and due to the agency of the situation, so there is a justification as to why the minister is going to declare without having to ensure that the requirements of CADRA are met. They say if there is a due urgency of the situation, the minister may proceed with a declaration without prior consultation with or affording a prior hearing to any affected person. But as soon as this is possible after the declaration contemplated in section 17.3, the minister must consult and afford a hearing to any affected person, must consider any representations during such consultation or hearing, and confirm, vary, or cancel the declaration contained. Then sub-14, they are also adding, it says, if the minister is of the opinion that the owner failed to comply with a notice issued in terms of sections 3 and 4, he or she may take reasonable steps to remedy the situation, recover the consequential damages or costs from the owner or person concerned, and approach a competent court for any appropriate relief. So in this instance, what is basically happening, there is an empowerment to the minister that the forest may be declared as a controlled forest area without consulting those that will be affected. However, then 14 brings in an issue that once there is an issue of non-compliance, they are also empowering the minister to take those steps that are mentioned out there. Now, the issue, as I said, the issue of Kaja comes in as to whether, in terms of Section 4 of Kaja, which outlines how can you avoid a Public Administration Act to be found as arbitrary. In that provision, there's Section 4.4 of Kaja, which permits departure from the manner that Kaja requires any administrative action to be dealt with. In this instance, and in this provision, we are thinking, even though the department will have to elaborate and explain properly their thinking in the background thereof, they meant to take advantage of Section 4.4 of Kaja, that they provide a provision that allows them to depart from the general way that the administrative action must be properly done. For instance, it says, where the minister has made a decision that there are situations that call for agency in terms of having to protect a specific forest, therefore, instead of going through the process of public hearings and calling on consultations and representations, if that process is put in place, the forest will be degraded and the forest will eventually be non-existent because of whatever they may have found. So it allows for the minister to quickly make the notice and make the declaration so that people or whatever that was being done to deforest the forest or to affect the forest will come to a halt, and then they will put the processes in place to either rehabilitate or do whatever is necessary. But the minister, in terms of this provision, is given a deviation from doing things with involving the public participation before making a decision, but later on can come back once they have tried to put the process that was taking away the conservation of nature that must be protected, that they put it in place before it gets spread. So what basically Clause 8 is doing is to deal with that, and that is why they're saying, for purposes of looking into this bill, this is one of the main provisions that needs to be given serious consideration and ensure that it is properly done in terms of legislation as well as the constitution, as well as the impact that it will have on to the people on the ground. And then the second part of Clause 8, as I said, the subsection 14, it lists a number of things from Roman figure 1 to Roman figure 3 there. And those that are listed, this is to the end, if you go through the bill and ensure that some opinion members are having a deal in their hands. As I read it out there, so that says, if the minister is that to voice the opinion that the owner of the forest has failed to comply with whatever notice and the declaration that it was saying. It empowers the minister to take reasonable steps so that they can remedy the situation. And Roman figure 2, it also allows the minister to recover consequential damages or costs from the owner. What you were basically saying here, I haven't read what the provision is indicating or is looking to achieve. And because they've used the term, the word end there to indicate that these three steps must run all together. It's not like they are using all to say one can stand on its own. So in instances where maybe the minister has opted to go for the option that departs from what PAJA requires, but then again come to invoke the empowerment of subsection 14 to the owner that has failed to comply, but the owner had reservations and was hoping to get a chance to bring their representation forward to the minister. But then the step jumps to that subsection 4 to where maybe the minister is now intending to take a remedial action without considering that there was that space which was left out of allowing people to have a chance. This is one of the provisions that will need to be interrogated as well as considered to see whether there isn't any shortcoming in terms of what the law requires and what the Constitution provides. But it's also providing that if that may be the case, the people are still given the opportunity to use their Section 34 of the Constitution to access the court and make sure that the Constitutional Court deals with the issue properly. But it's one of the instances that will possibly have some contentious matters. So. And then the next provision, which I also thought we need to look at, in terms of the Principal Act, and because this one was I'm actually presenting it on behalf of my colleague, so, but I did get a chance to just quickly peruse the Principal Act. The Principal Act did not have the appeal process, but in this instance, that is why the proposed one, Section 57A, they are bringing in the process that for anything that is done in terms of this act, you can appeal, and they are setting out that you appeal to the minister, and the process will have to be set out in the regulation. As I said, this is the process which will basically allow for appeal to wherever the party who is affected is not satisfied or not happy. But then again, if you look at the provision itself, it makes the appeal from the actions by the officials and not the appeal on the action by the minister. So there is a little bit of mishap there, whether it was intentional on the part of the department or whether there was an assumption that automatically, as I mentioned Section 34 earlier on, that there is always the right to access court at any time when you are aggrieved. Whether they are putting that in place, it sometimes it's not advisable to take an assumption, but rather get the clarity, and perhaps it was something that the department missed out. So as I indicate, perhaps this is also an issue that the department will need to clarify in processing the bill forward, and whether this is the process where there are processes that they may have within the department internally which are not legislated, or there are other instances except other than going to court, because we know that there's always the issue of costs when one has to go to court. That is basically the National Forest Bill Chapter 10 presentation.
Thank you, any comments or questions or comments, honorable colleagues?
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. Chairperson, many of the questions that I have will probably have to be posed to the department, but I just want to know, how do we distinguish whether a forest is indigenous and not indigenous? I would imagine all forests are indigenous. None of them tell me about both. Sandeep, tell me about both?
Yeah.
Okay.
This is whether any research has been done to strengthen the view that indigenous law or customs will not be affected. I'm putting this question at this stage of the process because this seems to be the view based back by the legal team. My second question is, I'm taking advantage of the fact that the minister is here. What would the minister have considered that he or she would intervene in the case of the example that was given, like deforestation taking place, and then they've got to cut through everything and just stop the process? The minister may not feel obliged to answer now.
Is he scared of me?
No, I'm kidding. I understand.
And on that, are we now taking control of the indigenous forest, totally as forestry of the whole section that's falling there, as to all that one, because it's very difficult if you have these overlapping sections where we're not sure what is what.
So just one question. Is there any piece of legislation that allows an unpaid person to appeal to the president if he can't if he can't go down to a court of law?
Thank you, Chairperson. May I quickly deal with the last question? I have to be honest to say that I did not specifically go and find if there is legislation that enables that. It was just a mere example, but that can be sorted out as well. And from the top of my head, I cannot recall of any specific one that I can mention right now which set out that specific instance on whether the president can be involved in the appeal processes of what happens within the public administration. On all the other questions, the first one being what is there to help us distinguish between any other forest as opposed to an indigenous forest? Basically, my answer to that would be, for purposes of legislation, that is why most of every legislative measure, there is a section one which deals with the definition, because they want to maintain the ambit of that specific legislation, and that is why you must restrict yourself to the definitions that are provided within that act. In this instance, for an example, the bill itself, it does seek to explain to define natural forest and woodland, and where they include the term indigenous forest as well. But if you look at other related and relevant legislation, it defines the extent of the ambit of what it is they mean by indigenous forest, as opposed to just understanding that any forest should be a natural forest. The second question, which related to whether there has been imperial research or research that's done on indigenous law and how these are impacting on them. From our office, and for purposes of this exercise, we've only done the research considering, for purposes of tagging, and how the process in terms of Section 18, as well as what Section 18 requires, has been done, and what the judgments have interpreted the provision to assist us in the implementation of this term. But in terms of practicalizing this and understanding the gist, that definitely from our office perspective has not been done. The other question I would leave out, because as indicated, it's a question posed for the minister. On the question whether we have investigated the environmental legislation and look at the conflict and look at whether the environmental laws are not overlapping and or flaunted or usurping the power that is provided there. For purposes of this exercise, environmental laws were not considered in their full extent, but it was merely just to address what these provisions are saying in relation to the principal act. So that is still work that is still outstanding, which we definitely are going to undertake. I think Chairperson, I've covered all of them.
Thank you very much. Let's go to the Honorable Malone.
No, this one is not a question. I think it's just a suggestion that the legal advisors must go and investigate the question I posed as to whether a decision of an EA can be can be appealed to the president, or whatever term, English is gone, because the first language. Go and investigate that part, because from where I'm sitting, you know, in a department, the buck stops with an EA. And if any person is aggrieved and so on, that person can approach a competent court of law, but not appeal to the president. They can just go and investigate if there is such a piece of legislation that suggests that a person can appeal to the president, a decision of a minister, can come back to us and then we can look at that. But for now, from where I'm sitting, after the EA, we can go to the court of law. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. Let's agree that they must go and investigate this and face it when it comes back. Can we then go to the last week? Thank you.
important that as we are going to deal with this legislation, members must have it so that we are able to look at the content of the policy. So the white paper is the gist of what should happen with the forest. Let's go to the last one.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, Chairperson, is B22 also from last year. If you look at its cover page, it was also introduced as a proposed Section 75. And on most similar reasoning with the other national forests, but there is other additional ones on this one. Our office, in advising the JPM, we also felt that perhaps this one should rather be tagged as a Section 76 bill. In this instance, it is a bill. If one looks at the scheduled matters, we found that it is a bill that falls within the administration of indigenous forests, and it also, to a certain degree, does fall to the issue of traditional leaders, because this one, amongst the other things it seeks to do, is to enable the minister and the officials of the department to facilitate the formation of fire associations in areas where they feel that it is necessary, because the fires are rife or are occurring in a very measurable instances to destroy the forest or to destroy any other nature thing. As when one does the tagging process, you cannot do it abstractly. You need to look into the provisions of the bill itself and the content of the bill. And in this instance, we just, for purposes of the presentation, are bringing into the attention of the committee clauses 2 and 6, which basically in this instance we are saying are the provisions that involve both the administration of indigenous law and traditional leaders. In clause 2, it says and involves the municipality in this instance, which is another provision that will have to make it be a Section 76 bill. It says in that additional subsection which must be entered there, 3A under clause 2 of the bill, the municipality concerned, and in the case of a communal land, a traditional council established in that area in terms of Section 3 of the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act, if any, may facilitate the formation of a fire protection association process as contemplated in Section 3, if the minister is of the opinion that a fire protection association is required. Clause 6 as well is another provision that empowers the traditional leader to be part of the enforcement structures. And if you look at what Chapter 12 of the Constitution in terms of how to regulate on traditional leaders and what existing powers they have, and if there are any additional allocations of powers that must be done, and as the Traditional Leadership Framework Act is the legislation that has stemmed out of Chapter 12 of the Constitution, which was required that national legislation must be enacted in that regard. So having read the specific provisions that I've read on the bill and the extent of the powers that they want to either add or extend to the traditional council within the structure of traditional leadership, it does then in that instance bring in the ambit of the application of the traditional leadership framework in considering all the processes that relate to tagging, as well as all the legal requirements or legislative requirements that must take place. So as we have indicated, we are of the view that this bill deals with the administration of indigenous forests in general, and it also seeks to include the assistance or to call on additional empowerment on the powers and functions of traditional leaders in respect of traditional councils. And it also then touches on traditional leadership and nature conservation. And then having it touching on those three, which are listed matters in terms of Chapter 4 of the Constitution, we have then advised that this should be a bill that is pegged by the JPN to be a Section 76 bill. And we have dwelt so much on the matter of tagging and how the bill is processed, because on most times the constitutional contention comes out on the process itself. Hence, that is why in this bill we have sort of put a lot of time and consideration in terms of ensuring that the proper process is followed in terms of this bill, even though, as I said, they may look simple and straightforward, but once you sit down and look at the content itself and how it explains its impact on those provisions, it becomes rather pragmatic. And so, having said that, they are providing functions for the traditional council, and in terms of Section 20 of the Traditional Leadership Framework Act, there is a requirement there. And because it's legislated, it's a compliance that we have to ensure that it's been done. So for purposes of Section 20, we inquired with the department whether they did consider Section 20 of the Traditional Leadership Framework and whether the consultation that is legislated and required in terms of that provision was done. And from the responses that we got before the end of last year, it was indicated that the minister and all the officials had complied with what Section 20 requires, which was basically consultation that must take place, ministerial concurrence with the minister of traditional affairs, as well as the MEC responsible for traditional affairs within the provinces, and also consult the structures of traditional leadership, as well as consultation with SAUDA. All these are actually specified out in Section 20 of the traditional leadership. But the department did give us a confirmation or assurance that they did comply with this provision.
Honorable Sultan, where you go?
It's Valentine's Day, so I'm still in love with public works. I'm joining public works.
No, we have the minutes to adopt. Last time we didn't adopt the minutes because people don't know what they're doing. So you are not.
Can I come back at half past 12?
Half past 12, yes.
I will. I'll honor my word.
Please.
Thank you.
Please.
And the final point, Chairperson, on this one is that also, in terms, even if it seeks to empower or provide functions to the traditional council, the consultation and everything is outlined in the clauses, will be done, but we also felt that it is not necessarily a bill that falls within the ambit of Section 18 that requires a direct referral by the Secretary to Parliament to the National House of Traditional Leaders. This also is a bill that has about, I think, 6 clauses, Chairperson. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much, Chairperson. I'm just checking, there's nothing about the forest, forested plantation. So it doesn't talk about the forest, plantation forest. I'm not sure, because indigenous, which is natural, then there are these two that we plant. So what about those?
Thank you for the question. You asked that question when we meet with the department. Just write it down so that you don't forget. Thank you very much, Honorable Member. Thank the legal team of the department. We will now, because we've been briefed what is entailed in the bill, in the next meeting we'll have the department. Members should then, then have time to engage each clause of the bill. And all the issues of constitutionality, whether how the bill, what is more important, how is this bill or the bill is going to affect the constituency that we represent. That is very critical and important that as we are going to engage in this issue. Thank you very much. Our room is very big, so we have to very much. We are now present. I'm going to hand it over to the minister to lead in the discussion. You are welcome to
Thanks to the members of the committee. I'm sure the team will present the processes. But just to say, as a department, when we made aware of the this unknown test initial, a lot of work was done by our scientists to identify this unknown pesticide, and working with ARC, the University of Northwest, in South Africa, assisted a lot, and our department was able, therefore, to identify this as fall under work. And I'm sure our team will go on to explain what has been done since then, but I have to say that other than the work that the department was engaged in yesterday, we went to the Popo in Mokopa and among the areas we visited, with the four farms, two commercial farms, and the two farms owned by small-scale farmers, identified what has been done. One of the challenges when we became aware that the worm was small armyworm was to look at whether there was a pesticide, sorry, from the farm, that there were pesticides that were available, but they were not registered. And we have to make sure that they are registered so that as farmers apply them, they work within the specifications of the producers. I will leave this process to the departmental team. Let me say that the department works overtime in trying to make sure that we do this work. And not much could have been done before we could identify and know what we are dealing with, so that the public is not let alone to panic and believe that we will still end up without any harvest or maize or food security because of this challenge. I can say that we now know that we know which pesticides do work. We have seen the impact after application thereof, and I'm sure the team will give the details of what we are dealing with. Mr. Ranasudi leads the team as the acting director general. As our DG is attending a meeting in Rome, I think the apology was not given earlier. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Honorable Minister, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members of the Portfolio Commission of the Health and Fisheries. With me today is the team that deals with plant health within the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries. That unit has got a few areas that are of importance to the discussion today. One around early warnings, and secondly around the controls, including the management of pests. So we have got the director of plant health today, Madam Alice Baxter, who is sitting just behind the minister. And we have got the presenter, who is the manager within the component, and also a scientist that does a lot of work around exotic pests, Jan Hendrik Bender, who is going to do the presentation. Apart from that, we also have got a team from the Agricultural Research Council, who are dealing with a lot of work that is being done around here, led by Dr. Roger Price, sitting behind Mr. Yanundi's center on the other side. And also next to Madam Aljo, we've got Dr. Ansepatin, who is going to be also assisting in terms of responding to the issues that honorable members have on this meeting. We are
are aware that there are a lot of questions in terms of this, and we'll shoot straight to the presentation. The presentation will paint the picture in terms of what this person that we are dealing with is all about. It would give us what the steps that the department has undertaken thus far, and it will also inform on the next steps that we need to undertake as a department to deal with this person. And without any further much ado, I would ask Mr. Fenter just to take us through the presentation. Thank you very much, Chair.
Good morning, Honourable Minister, Honourable Members. Yes, as you can see in the introductory slide, that is the moth, the caterpillar, and then some damage that it does on people. That's the big start. I will go through the background status in South Africa, forest range and life cycle, identification and damage, control measures, and the role of agriculture, forests and fisheries together with the provincial Department of Agriculture. Right, this piece is a migratory moth species. Now this piece doesn't only get into an area and fly to new areas, but it gets into new areas, multiplies up to a point where population pressure is very high, then it starts migrating. And it can migrate over very large distances. In the United States, for instance, it can migrate from southern states up to Canada. That's over 2,000 kilometers. So it's not something that goes from one point to another point in a short period of time. It can go quite quickly. Scientific name is Podoptera fuliparva, and its common name is called four army worm, mainly because just before fall or autumn in the United States, it gets its peak in population numbers and then it dies out in the colder states in the United States. As I've already said, it originates from southern states of America as well, but it is more largely spread or prevalent in South America and Central America areas, where it is a pest as far south as Argentina. There also the cold gets to it and it cannot establish. It's a serious pest. It does affect quite a number of plants, and where it does affect the plant, it can cause quite considerable damage. In Africa, it has been reported in 2016 and first in Nigeria around about January. Then in December, it was reported from almost from the west coast to the east coast in Africa. And that is Namibia, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Malawi, and also now in South Africa and Botswana. However, there's very few official reports of this pest in Africa. Most of the reports is within semi-government organizations and within the media. The media has been reported widely, but with different photographs of different pests in those reports, which makes the report very unreliable in that context. So confirmation is needed from an official level in most cases, which we are also working on. A loss has been reported 30-60%, and that mainly is also in the media, so one needs to be sure it is because of this pest and not other Lepidoptera pests, such as African armyworm, for instance. As I said, the adults are strong flyers, and they can go from one point to another in a very short period of time. They make use of wings and feather fronts to disperse. This pest has been a quarantine pest for South Africa since the early 2000s, when it was realized that this pest is a serious pest. It has been listed on our import condition for plant material. In other words, it would be illegal to bring in a plant into South Africa without a permit. And in those permits where this pest is listed, it must be declared from the foreign country that it does not occur on that commodity. DAF has monitored through the early warnings unit, monitors press releases, monitors spread of pests through the country, as far as we can establish. And based on the media reports in Zambia and Papua and Malawi, we sent out an alert in 17 January this year.
that there's a fair spreading in Southern Africa, probably in the direction of South Africa. And that led to farmers starting to notify the department that they see some strange caterpillars in their crops and they don't know what it is. Now, after talking to the farmers afterwards, they all say that they first didn't realize it's something new, but after the damage became prevalent, they saw that it's something they haven't seen before. In other words, when the caterpillars are small, it's very indistinguishable from other caterpillars. Then we started the preliminary action group at 25 January, that's basically the next week, where we started to initialize a response and start to work with our industries and research organizations, our pesticide companies, etc., for the different actions needed to get out on the ground. For instance, larvae were protected. One of the ways to identify that the drop test positive is through identification of a moth. In other words, a moth is an adult phase. The life cycle, I will explain later a little bit, but it means that when you collect caterpillars, the caterpillars first have to change into a moth. If it doesn't change into a moth, it's very difficult to identify, specifically when it's a foreign thing. It hasn't been there yet. Because there's thousands and thousands of Lepidoptera species or moth species in the world, and it's very difficult just to work on a larva. Or a caterpillar. By 3 February, this was then identified by the IRC-PPRI, which is our national official ring that we use for official identification. Also, the national collection is curated by that division in South Africa. We've got a pest of cats and all over the place, as far as we can specimen. Right. As I said, it's got a wide nose range. It can attack over different species, but however, there's different strains, different types available or present in the world, and we don't know which exact type we have in South Africa. For instance, in the US, I talk about the rice type and the maize type. We certainly know in South Africa it's attacking maize, so we can presume it's a maize type. Further studies and genetic studies is necessary to determine which exact type we have on that. At the moment, our own laboratory in Stellenbosch, as well as the ARC, is working on better molecular techniques to identify even up to the type we have. The main host is maize, sorghum, groundnuts, cotton, soybean, and sugarcane. As documented in literature in South Africa, we've got positive confirmation on maize and on sorghum. And there's one report on soybean and a few on spinach. Those needs to be confirmed. We are not sure if it's really that the fall and an omnivore attacking those. Additional hosts are grasses, pasture grasses, which can also be attacked in some of the vegetable crops. I did yesterday, was in the field with the minister, and I did collect some larvae from the pasture grasses planted next to the maize field. That needs to be identified so we can make sure it is the same one. Distribution in South Africa so far. And as you can see, this has been reported widely by the media and elsewhere. And we've got reports from farmers mostly based on the numbers we've seen through to the press where they can report on. And that includes Messina, Fondus, Mazuri, Chukuma, Simon, Leo, Vivo, Martin, Baldwin, Paladini, Nakulele, Makutani, Masushani, Tunisburg, Makukong, Letitele, Bochum, Bella Bella, Texas, and Vestavinta. This is fairly widespread. Confirmed from Limpopo is Fondus, Messina, Mazuri, Vivo, Makutani, Masushani, Makukong, Tunisburg, which is very thick and rest of winter. This means that it's confirmed that it's widespread in the Limpopo. It doesn't mean every area in the Limpopo is affected. And in the rate, the magnitude of the infestation is in northern and eastern parts of the Cape Town mainly, and it's been confirmed at components of pyramids are destroyed in the area. Northwest, the western part, is confirmed resting by the Swat Ruggins. Schumann's Kloof in Mpumalanga, as well as in Zinga and Middleburg, is confirmed. And I had some reports of Bosport Ridge, which is not confirmed. The Free State, one report of Peter Stein, and the Northern Cape, one report of Douglas. The host plants reported, as I said earlier, maize mainly, but especially sweet corn and some of the seed maize varieties, mainly open pollinated varieties are attacked, and then also soft corn. Just to give you an idea of the life cycle, it's between 24 and 40 days that it takes to develop from an egg up to a new adult. It means that the adult on its own have to be able to fly over large distances, survive, lay eggs, and that egg will then develop a next, well, that egg development to a new adult will take another 4 to 40 days. I tend to spend too much time on the life cycle, certainly means that is what I can explain between pupil stages, 7 to 13 days, it means that we develop an adult larva. You can say an adult larva, the last phase of a larval phase, or a caterpillar stage. It will take another 7 to 13 days before we get another adult to have a positive identification. However, with molecular techniques, we can be able to identify the larva already from an early phase. So the larva development from life stage 1 to 6 will take also 14 to 20 days, depending on the temperature, climatic conditions, etc. How to identify the spore organism? On caterpillars, you can have a good idea on the last phases of, in other words, the fifth and the sixth stage of the larva, and you will see there's two broad black bands along the side, but more characteristically, there's four black spots at the around about the second last and third last segment of the tail. That is the left-hand arrow that goes up to there, which is forming a square. And the most obvious would be a reverse, a Y-formed white tail, which you would see on the face. If you look right into the eye, just like the dust of human, you know, the magnifying glass, then you could see that Y-shape, upside-down Y-shape. Just to look at the eggs, they lay eggs in packs on the knees, and it's quite easy to see these packs for scouting. Even the other males are still short. And the male is very dense, very difficult to see. The pupa is hard to see the signature from a lot of other caterpillars. As the larva has explained, and in the adult you will see a lot of pattern on the wings, etc. But for the average guy, this looks like a moth. It's very difficult to distinguish on that. You need an expert. And it actually means an expert now to dissect the moth to be able to know the positive identification. And it can only be done on male moths. Some of the damage, they feed on the adults lay eggs on the leaves, the eggs hatch, and then the small larvae start to feed on the leaves, and they make their way into the wool of the leaves. In other words, there's a leaf is around the stem of the maize, when they go into that opening there, and they feed their way until they develop into bigger larvae inside that area. And it can also be in the tussles, etc. So they generally feed on forage, but during the early gestation larvae will also feed on the corn ears, or the maize ears in this country. Thorough damage to maize is usually characterized by a ragged feeding. You will see in the point of it, you will see the shaggy, ragged type of appearance of a leaf when it's been set on. And then they go into the leaf wall and they cause the damage. And you'll see there also damage on the crop and also damage on the leaves. And then they also, you will see when they start pluming or they make the
tassels that can be damaged, and use of tassels is needed for pollination and will then not get a good quality that is good enough.
Yes, sir.
It's necessary to control this pest. In South Africa, we had no registered chemicals when this pest entered the country. But we are very hard work from the registered trust office. We are proud to say that we have 9 chemicals now, active ingredients now registered in the last 2 weeks. And those are listed there, Indoxacar, Fluorantra, Millipro, Simamethin, Benzoate, Fluden, Diamide, Lupronon, Methylmol, Indoxacar, Novalaron, it's a mixture, and Malafon, Hydrochemicals. Those are the chemicals that's registered now to be made, to be used against this pest. And there's still a long list of chemical companies that supply. How it works is the registrar cannot register a chemical if there's no application from a chemical company. So a chemical company has to register them, and we will register and evaluate it in terms of this emergency, and if it's valid, we can register it. Also to take note that this is a new pest. There's a lot of farmers that need chemicals, so there's a lot of backlog on the importation by the chemical companies on these chemicals, and that's why we make it broad as possible to make the strain on the importation not so hard. The producers are advised to scout. The best way to control this pest is early. Early detection is essential to control this pest. Once these larvae are getting older than 1 centimeter, it means that they fit into a leaf wall. They are not visible. It's difficult to see them. It's difficult then also for pesticides to reach them. But also by then, often, if the maize crop is too high. So when our maize crop is getting high, many farmers don't have equipment to spray with a tractor. So then the tractor will simply damage the maize. So it is essential that the correct spraying techniques are used, but early detection is the best defense. And that way you can defend. In Brazil, for instance, where the pest is prevalent, it's always there, and most times of the year, after 20 days they start the first spraying, and then they spray not too often because it kills natural predators as well. So the idea then is when the maize are just 20 days old, then they spray, and then it's the best chance to control cholera. This armyworm, because it migrates, it often gets to the maize when the maize is quite mature, and it's also difficult to detect, which means it's more important. The control pest guideline is updated on a weekly basis, and it is available on the DAF webpage, and several other companies are also leading on that. Such as Grain SA, the pesticide companies, etc., and they are linking on that, so that's available, and on there you can see which pesticides are recommended to be used, and also the scouting protocol. Scouting protocol is not on yet. I was waiting for that for it to be on today. But it's there, you know, it's there. Precautionary measures. All this pest is, you have to make sure that you don't buy the wrong pesticides. There's a lot of news in the media, there's a lot of rumors. Make sure that you discuss it with pesticide representatives and in accordance to what is registered for this pest. For the simple reason, some of the pesticide doesn't work because this pest is already resistant against some, for instance, parathroids. But not all parathroids. There's some indication when the pest is very small, some of the parathroid groups can work. But that needs to be tested. So be advised that this pest can be controlled, but it can be bad recommendations as well. When you apply chemicals, it needs to be done exactly according to the label listed requirements. Cannot deviate too much from that because this thing control is not applicable. In other words, the dosage rates must be exactly right, and also you have to use it as a young larva, as I said before. Older larvae are very difficult to control, etc. I did see some control yesterday where a farmer used Loran Millipro as an active ingredient.
very successful. I collected a lot of dead lava in this field, big and small lava. So it does seem that it works, and it does work, but also then the maize is still being done. What do we have? What arms do we have against this? Internationally wise, we are signatory members of, I think it's a signatory member of International Fraud Protection Convention. That is our official reporting structure for fraud protection. That is where all member countries, and most other countries are members, have to report new occurrences on an official basis. That's what we use as verification that the test is present in the country. Likewise, we do the same. And we have reported this test last week on the International Fraud Protection Convention that it's present in South Africa. Also, we have Agricultural Pests Act, which is a fairly old act, but it's a very effective act of control, which helps us to control pests, which is needed in the country and also migratory pests. For instance, you would know the migration of brown locusts in South Africa as well as red volquillas. Those are, for instance, controlled by that act. That also all the importation of plant foods are controlled by that act, and national control of pests. Then we have the plant health policy, which is combining all of these aspects, and also the IPPC, and in terms of the WTO agreement on sanitary and phytosanitary measures. Then South Africa has developed in 2012, which was approved by Executive Committee in 2013, the Emergency Plant Pest Response Plan, which is a basically emergency plan to deal with plant pest outbreaks, which we are following. Right. Just a summary on technical control. Is that we have to have developed documents, and we've developed now a scouting protocol. As I referred to earlier, there's a reporting template for all the role players involved where they report sightings, and that is sent to DAF. We evaluate and we can respond according to that. It also gives us an idea of where the thing is spreading and how fast it's spreading. And there's a pest factory developed by the ARC, which is available on the ARC website right now, which is a very good information, beautiful fact sheet which can be used. And then there's the interim pest management guidelines that helps us to pick the correct pest. What is DAF doing? DAF at the moment is providing leadership, mainly legislative and policy as well. We are running a steering committee with industry and research that meets on a weekly basis, and then joint operational committees within DAF, which is on a daily or two daily basis as need be. Then we also have joint operational committees established in the provinces. The Honourable Minister and DG have sent out letters to provinces to nominate contact points for DAF in which they which can serve on the steering committee so that we can have interaction all the time. And also on the steering committee is ARC, Northwest University, I think it was referred to earlier, as well as the pesticide watchdogs, CropLife and IRAC, which is looking at residue levels. Then we also involve the surveillance and monitoring awareness. There's an extensive awareness program going with provinces as well as in the farmers there, etc. And then inspections and issuing regulatory orders when needed. We're developing a data bank for all pest reports so that we can track of that. There will be a map of the spread of the pest produced this week after all the information has been collected from last week. And that will be updated also on a weekly basis. We have registered the chemicals as previously said. We solicit relevant resources to lead to national coordination. All the provinces that's affected, mainly the Corporal Health team from along the way, they come to the ballpark, they are playing along with us in a serious manner, they've committed their personnel. I think if we can testify to yesterday's seriousness of the whole issue, it was taken up very, very good. The guys are mobile in the corporal, they're active in doing this thing, and we get very good results and information from what's going on in the corporal. We also have as I said, notified the IPCC. What I'd left out is that we also sent letters to our neighboring countries informing them that we have a threat. Just to give you an overview in a clear way, is we've got the structure there as the four armament steering committee with industry, research, and 9 provinces involved in that. We are still waiting for some of the provinces to send members through to us. But those that we have contact, we work with them. Then we also have our internal jocks, as I said earlier. And then there's supposed to be 9 provincial jocks, and not all of them have been established yet, but I can testify that those mostly affected in Mpofu, Gauteng, and Mpumalanga already has also one. We're still waiting for one from Gauteng. Then we have technical expertise who is meeting and developing technical information for us. Research groups are on their own, and then there's interaction on a lateral basis as well. And there's a lot of guys in the field currently doing surveys, doing assessment to see what is going on. The role of the TDAs is exactly what I've said now, is that they're scouting, they're collecting, they're reporting, they conduct awareness with staff on that and educate the producers what's happening. They solicit resources for the control, for agricultural chemicals, traps, for instance. They promote internal pest management, which needs to be developed for the pest, and it's a new pest, it's not there yet. We don't know, for instance, in South Africa, which natural enemies we can make use of in the IPM, and they participate in the relevant joint actions for that. Right. Then we have the contacts, and that is mainly my contact there, and for awareness, promotional contacts is Mr. Mpho Sekgala and Ms. Ndani Chibongi, which is all within DAF, and then we also have the application for renewal permits in case that at this stage is not necessary for our inspection services. Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much for the presentation, and we want to thank Minister for the work that you are doing on the one of these issues, because we are very worried as a committee about what might be the impact of this insect on our people. So we welcome the input, but it also allows
also first thank the chair for considering the upper fiscal order. And then secondly, also appreciate, join the chair in appreciating the report from the department. This is really first encouraging and giving hope. But there's a number of questions that I would also like to ask the department. First, unfortunately, for my part, is that I have a weakness of estimating the capacity of the department. I always expect more. First is the question of how new is this thing. I'm asking this question because I know the word armyworm is not new. I heard about 2011. I don't know whether it was really the armyworm or it was something similar to it, and therefore maybe I need some clarity on that part. Also, the relation between the research from the department and the report from the media, because I think maybe the information that department would have on the face of their research would always be very useful and more efficient, rather than only hearing from the media, because they are always on the ground. Now the other thing is on this pest, I'm worried about its breeding and whether there is any possible way of combating it at any stage of breeding or even before breeding. See, I have a memory that the Cubans destroyed the malaria by killing the mosquito wherever they can breed. Just make sure that they can't breed in that area. So I think maybe something can be done in preventing this breeding. The only chemicals, I wonder if I'm fearing also that there will be a competition of the manufacturers of the chemicals. Is there any way that the department is going to work efficiently on this, including the way of establishing if there it can be any recommended combination of the pest control that can be useful in this respect? Are the researchers maybe, we have an idea that it is possible maybe in the research that the manufacturers of our can make maybe a breed or a cultivar that tastes very bad for these creatures who are worrying us. I'm also thinking of, now you talked about the of the processes, and I didn't hear much about another information process, for instance, a flyer that can run to the producers or to the farmers on a daily basis, wherever they are, they get information about this. And another thing is whether in this communication, the farmers can be able to call a number at any time when they see the pest immediately without necessarily going a long process. And lastly, what is the best method or easiest method to assist now the poor rural farmers, because these attacks can increase fly and run to them where there is not enough communication. Thank you, Chef.
On children, it is that this, the life cycle of this is 40 days. I'm just checking now, how long can it take now to fly from Southern America to Canada? Perhaps now before this 40 days. I think now perhaps by that time would have died on the way, but I'm just checking such a long time. Another question is about some of these pesticides now may not work. Then I want to check perhaps now if these are not checked or monitored by the department so that we don't buy things that are not going to assist us with. So there is information or monitoring so that we buy the correct pesticides. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. It seems delinquency is a tendency in honorable partner organization. Chairperson, I thank you very much for the presentation, Mr. Ramasodi and Mr. Finter. In terms of
disrupting the meeting chair.
How?
No, but meeting is in change, don't
Chairperson. I'll be ready next time. Chairperson, I'd like to know in terms of whenever there are tests like this, and I always think that the people that are going to really benefit out of this are these pesticide manufacturers, and they can be artist people. So I'd like to know in terms of we have on the support where we produce our own the necessary pesticides and everything. So how proactive are we in making sure that we are going to produce our own pesticides instead of allowing probably some American organization to come and sell us the pesticides for the pests that they are propagating? And in terms of the department, Mr. Fenter said that at a certain stage it's difficult to spray the crops because of the height of the crop, and it cannot be sprayed by tractor. But there are other means also of distributing, spraying the crops and work very effectively for a farm in Stellenbosch a couple of years ago, where the institution where I worked to produce drones that could go and spread the pesticides. And is the department looking at how they could assist farmers? I mean, this is our maize and wheat crops are very important for food security of the country. So are we producing, number one, first question, are we looking at producing our own pesticides? And number two, are we going to assist farmers that are unable to spray the crops? Are we going to assist them? Thank you very much, Jefferson.
Thank you.
Chairperson, I want to thank you for putting this on the agenda. I think it is quite important that we are informed of what's going on, and also thank you for the involvement in the presentation. The questions that I would like to ask is firstly, when this was reported in Africa during 2016, starting from January 2016, what plans were put in place at that stage? I'm concerned, Chair, and I've looked back, tried to see when did we start reacting to this, and it was also mentioned in the presentation that alert went out on the 17th of January. Especially knowing that this thing can fly thousands of kilometers and that it can spread very easily. So I would like to know, before the 17th of January, was anything done by the department? My concern, secondly, to that, Chair, is the word that the scouting protocol is not yet in place. Because I would have thought that that would have been the first thing, already in October, or whenever it was said that this is now spreading rapidly in Africa, that we would have put some kind of spread scouting thing in or surveillance in place. And if it wasn't done, why was that not done? Then, Chairperson, the second thing is the cost of this. I spoke to some farmers this morning and I said they're spraying at around 600 rand a hectare, which is a massive cost. And that is just the pesticide. So if you have to have drones or helicopters, or not helicopters, flying machines and all kinds of other things, does the department know what kind of cost is involved? To spray this, and linked to that, I would like to find out, and do you know if we only have to spray once? Because I listened carefully that you have to spray them when they fall small, the plants and the worms. So obviously if they recycle, or the cycle period is 24 days or 14, there could be, you know, they could be in different phases at the same time on a field. That's what I think in my mind could happen. So you can't just spray once, you'll have to spray maybe a few times. Do you have some answers on that, and any tests were done?
Then, Chairperson, according to the Agricultural Theft Act, I read it, Section 8 says that the minister may, out of monies appropriated then, but that act is old, so it still speaks about locusts mostly, make money available. Where the department has put some money available, especially to help the small-scale farmers that won't be able to afford this, and also there's also other commercial farmers that might not be able to afford this, so that we kind of contain this, whether money is available to do that or not, and whether we need to ask Treasury for money to assist. And then lastly, Chair, the question that I wanted to find out, I know that now it's registered, some of these pesticides, but is it ready to be available in South Africa already? Because that is also one of the concerns. That's it now. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, Chairperson, I just wanted to know and also agree with what my colleague has said about the control measures that is in place to stop. If it comes from America, how did it get to Africa? It couldn't have flown over the sea, so it must have come here in some sort of way with some host. And do we have those control measures in place to stop it from happening or to have the adequate, like I said, measures in place? And then if we need to spray and we need to contain this and it's an emergency that can take away quite a bit of our crops, can't we ask the Air Force to help us to spray the goods? Or it's a national emergency and they have aeroplanes and not everybody can afford it, and the department and the Air Force maybe to help in these efforts, especially in outlying areas. It's all one government. Thank you.
That's why we're getting the army.
Thank you.
I will not dwell with technical questions, but I will, let's to say we have arranged an emergency minimax on the 17th jointly with the Department of Rural Development with the aim of getting all MSCs and HODs and other senior people. Besides that, I've already written letters to provinces requiring them to ensure that they activate their personnel, especially the extension officer, so that they pick up if there are any developments that can be undertaken. Besides that, we have requested that all funds that are unspent from CASA should be put together into a pool, and I'm sure we'll get maybe the information as to how much. But when we're in Limpopo, already there, put aside plus minus 8 million rand to begin to assist, especially the small scale farmers. Even the commercial farmers, those we met yesterday, requested that if possible they be assisted given the scale. And let me say that one of the problems is what has been outlined, that when the maize is already torn, you cannot be able to use your normal spray that you use when you do it. That would be less costly using a tractor, because the maize now is taller, therefore you need to use other methods. And I'm sure, but in those two, in the farms we have visited, we have seen the fact that the applied pesticides do are effective. Those farmers, I mean, while they could, they were worried initially. With those we have seen, they are quite satisfied with the fact that now, the fact that they know that there are pesticides that have been identified, registered, they are now, the issue now would be how do all farmers be able to buy those. Those are issues that we are dealing with as a department. On the issue of why we didn't, honorable state, I think we must take note of the fact that in the continent or in agriculture, people are very cautious sometimes to declare when they have got problems. Looking at it, it is pretty common that those who are, the markets will be more cautious. It may not be due to our fault, but the system. Hence, as we speak, two of our people are in Harare to deal, among others, in a meeting organized by FAO. By the way, we forgot to say that FAO has been part of the team. Even yesterday, they were there, they are supporting, they are coordinating the region in as far as detecting some of this. Let me tell you, as a department, I think we do detect some of these pests. I have been informed just now that there's one that is in Ethiopia, is the Asian citrus pest that is still oncoming. We are aware already, but we can only be aware if such are publicized, and then we catch up and begin to do work. I'm not saying we defend, I'm saying that sometimes we're aware that we're dealing with the plethora of other pests. But what has made it easier to stop borers with others, because we know, as you begin to prepare your maize, you also include such a For this one, I don't think anybody may claim to have known that it is already here. On the issue of how it was brought in, I'm sure maybe what we know is that those moths can fly very fast with the wind. Whether they can fly across the from Canada to here, I'm sure that is something else we can be able to deal with. On the questions that were raised and answered by Honorable Paulson, whether OPP can now change from vaccine to pesticide is another debate I think we need to deal with. Because you are implying that the benefit will go to, and of course the department, we need to engage the producers of this in terms of looking at prices, even trying to get even neighboring farmers who can have the mechanisms to apply, depending on what will be put up in place, because we are now in trying to get as much funding as possible. Once funding is up, and so those are things I think can be dealt with, as to say, those who have, for instance, one farmer, we advise him to go to his neighboring farmer who he has worked with before. We have got the necessary machinery to spray. But the fact that now at least we have identified its biology, its origin, and the rest, gives us the best chance to deal with. As to the issue of how do we make sure that the word is spread, so that we don't rely on the media that will report in a way that can create panic. We I'm sure those are things that I think have been taken up, as to say how often, but I can assure you, since this pest came up, one guy was jokingly saying, I may dream of this pest because I speak about them now and again. Be it in Sotho, my broken Sotho, or English, or whatever language. We try our best as a department to give as often as possible, but making sure that our information is based on fact, so that people are not given wrong information. So I think other people can take other questions. That's why I will stay away from questions that have got technicality. But also to say that with the limited, we really appreciate the support. Even the attitude of farmers we went to yesterday. I mean, they were also happy to say that the department has been trying its best even to give them information. One can say that not everybody can be able to go to our site and be able to understand what is happening. Those are things I think when we meet on Friday, we might outline what platform do we use to spread information to different cluster of people.
Thank you very much, Minister. I will allow the team to share the questions that you asked, and just to comment that there were a few pointers that we have taken from honorable members in terms of assisting us to go forward. The flyers that was outlined by we already had provided in terms of the ERC something of that sort, but we think that the idea can be developed better. The first one around the capacity of the department in terms of dealing with the test, Mr. Dealt with that. What we will deal with through Dr. Price would be the relation between the research by the GAF and what is currently happening. And we will also deal with the pest control issues. I think there were two pertinent issues where which stage do we attack the pest in? Can we then target it at different stages? And then there was an issue around the host specificity when we talk about maize, whether we cannot develop a cultivar that we take best to the pest itself, and we will give those to we will then go in terms of the questions that were asked by Honorable Jaise on how far can this test fly, and Dr. Price will respond to that too. Mr. Jan Hendrik Center responds to the issue around the rights, or how do you ensure that people have the right to decide? The question from Honorable Carlson, the issue around the government-owned pesticide manufacturers has been responded adequately by the Minister. There's an issue on proactive development of train programs and whether we need to use aerial applications for this test. And
we will answer whether Mr. Bolt agrees with any army around the
pesticide. Yes, Minister. And I will allow Madam Alexander just to go on the issue around aerial sprays and applications of pesticides. There were issues around the capacity of the department, and I think that it's an issue that we need to, I will deal with the issue around Section 8 of the Act and the availability of pesticides. Mr. Jan Hendrik Venter will respond to it, and then we will give to Dr. Kamisiba the issues around the control measures and how do we ensure that we have got adequate capacity. I think she has emphasized three pertinent issues around the need for money to deal with this, and the issue around and I'm responding to that too. Let me respond to the two issues that I indicated that I responded to. The first issue was what are the provisions in terms of Section 8 of the Act. If you read it, it says that it deals with pathogens, it deals with insects, and it also deals with predators. It means that once we have identified the extent of the pest, then what we need to have are new control measures that the minister will pronounce on to say that from a religious point of view, these are the control measures that we implement. These control measures may include the destruction of any pests or even plants that the pest might infest, but we still need to determine the extent of it. Once that has been determined, then the minister would engage the Minister of Finance in terms of how do we then make good the damage that we have incurred in terms of losing benefit by the farmers and maybe by food security concerns by the nation. So that is a step that's coming in terms of the current arrangements that we are having. What we have done is that we have come up now with a regulation that we need to sign off. That regulation says that each and every farmer who encounters fall anywhere on the farm, they have got to report it. It allows us to spot it, then we can say we have detected how far this pest has spread, and these are the control measures that the minister will pronounce on. The second issue that deals with the money issues. As minister has indicated, we have been engaging with treasury, and one of the areas that we have indicated that any surplus money that is within the cost allocation should be used for this purpose of the control of allocation. Secondly, in terms of our engagement with national treasuries to identify other sources of funding that can be used here, there are funds that we have identified, but we have got a meeting again with them tomorrow just to see how far we can stretch this one. But in terms of the broader controls, Minister would have to engage with the Minister of Finance. Thank you very much, Chair. I'll then give over to Dr. Price, followed by Madam Ali, Dr. Van Buren, and then lastly, Janine, just to wrap them up. Thank you.
First of all, there's a question about the African army worm. This is very similar. South Africa had outbreaks of African army worm. They originate in Central and Eastern Africa. We are subject to invasions about once every 5 to 10 years, sometimes serious invasions. The moths fly across the border and damage pastures and crops. But then, due to the temperatures, the onset of winter, these populations die out, and then they disappear, and then we wait 3 to 5 years, sometimes 10 years, and they come back again. This thing could be similar. It's a migratory army worm. What we don't know about this thing is, will it survive the winter in South Africa? temperatures were already starting to drop on the high veld, maize food, the main food producing area. So food security is where the maize, most of the maize crops are, is unlikely to be threatened immediately. But we're worried that if this thing starts to overwinter and survive the winter in the warmer areas, then our rural farmers, the smallholder farmers, are directly at threat. Maize breeding, yes, certainly a lot of research could identify varieties of maize, the traditional types of maize that are resistant to armyworm pressure. But at the moment, it looks like there's far less damage on the commercial GMO crops, far less. The traditional open pollinated and traditional varieties used by the small-scale rural farmers are getting hammered, and there's far less damage on, very little damage on double-stack genes, and virtually nothing reported on triple-stack genes. My colleague can advise on the terminologies and the varieties. At the steering committee, we've having very little information so far on the varieties that have been attacked, but that information will come in. The Grain SA was asked to provide that information. The information for resource poor farmers is vital. We've just put together a fact sheet in English, but that needs to be urgently translated into a range of languages and got out to these people in the field to at least know what they're dealing with. The ARC will be involved in coordinating some of those translations, but we have to get involved with the provinces to ensure that those things will be distributed. There was a question about natural enemies of these insects. Due to its migratory behavior, flying hundreds if not thousands of kilometers, any true indigenous natural enemies will be left well behind. There will be new associations. We will have to look in the future and see what our local parasites and predators, whether they attack this thing. But it's highly unlikely that we'll find something immediately. There will be lots of predators such as ants eating the eggs and things like that, but whether we can get something that's actually going to involve biocontrol of this thing, we'll have to wait and see. At the moment, we're well into probably the second generation of moths in South Africa. These are spreading around. Whether there's a third generation will depend on the early onset of winter. But as I say, the main concern we have as researchers is the overwintering and the residual population of this armyworm in the rural areas, in the low veld especially. And if it gets into KZN, into the sugar estates, then we've got another problem. The scouting protocol that has been developed at the previous steering committee meeting last week. That was due to be out immediately, so as Jan Hendrik says, we'll have a look today to see if it's available. The cost of application, 600 rand a hectare, is on the low side. We're getting indications that it could be a lot higher, especially when you've added the cost of machinery, the labour, the fuel. You may be talking 1,000 rand a hectare, and that's going to be prohibitive to most farmers. We have to spray when there are small instars. The small little larvae are the most vulnerable. Also, they once the larvae get big, they go into the bomb-proof shelter inside the maize plant. No matter if you drench the plant on the outside, it's not going to get, the insect isn't going to get the pesticide onto it. So the strategy to apply the pesticide is when the small instars are vulnerable on the outside of the maize or just as they're going into the whorls of the maize. But once they're in deep inside, then they're very well protected. And it's virtually impossible to spray the moths because you're just generating millions of moths, and we can attract these with pheromone traps to detect the migration, but whether we can do mating disruption at a later date is an option we'd have to look at, but this is a long-term research strategy. I think that's my bits on the biology of the insects.
Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, I think to a large extent the first slide already been answered regarding areas of scale. It's a very specific topic relying or requiring information on the chemicals that are needing to be applied, the stage of the crop and the crop that needs to be treated, and how one needs to approach the most cost-effective way of getting the appropriate chemical to where the pest is on the crop. So I know there's been some quite dramatic press from neighbouring countries using military aircraft to spray. I haven't seen reports on whether that was effective or not. We may need to in the future look at what has been referred to in terms of micro flying craft, which may be able to get into crops and into places in crops and fields where specific pesticides can be applied with more efficacy. But this is a very specific question, and the biology of the pest, the biology of the crop, and the interlinkages between the two would determine whether it would be a cost-effective way of dealing with it.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. My question related to how to ensure that we have adequate control measures in place, and I can maybe speak to that from the IRC's point of view and from the research point of view, that as scientists we need to certainly look at an integrated approach for a pest like this and look in our toolbox what is available. Unfortunately, there are many options available to us. The genetic modification of varieties with the new GMO events that is available, many of these events were engineered in the state specifically for control of the full army wound, and they are available in commercial varieties today in South Africa. That's a starting point. Secondly, as Dr. Price referred to, the use of alien varieties and undomesticated varieties with types that will repulse feeding is definitely an option. That's a long-term option. The use of registered pesticides, and the department has responded admirably to that challenge with the amount that has been registered in the time. That's an option. And then when we look at predation studies as a long-term, the use of mating disruptors, definitely an option. Biological control needs to be investigated. And then I think that what is very important is the monitoring. So the importation of the correct pheromones to detect the variants across borders, very important. So that needs to be implemented, as well as looking at both specificity, and I think Dr. Price referred to vitally important for us going into the winter is the pest ability to overwinter in warmer areas. And what will happen after overwintering? So what is the baseline population that we will be starting with? So there are certainly many, many things that we have in our toolbox as scientists to make sure that we have adequate control measures. A lot of them will depend on adequate funding being available to address those issues. Thank you.
It leaves me that there are little to answer still. The availability of chemicals has been a problem in some of the areas. However, that was lost with the African regions we will have to monitor that also. We do talk to our pesticide company. They are represented by CropWise at the steering committee meeting. That will be a discussion point tomorrow. We've got 9 active ingredients registered. Those chemicals are already used previously for other lepidoptera pests on bays in South Africa, which means are readily available leading vegetables to distributors throughout the mice production area of South Africa. All those chemicals. It's not new things that's been imported in South Africa. Great detail that's been there for a while. Also, what we've eliminated was those that are not effective in literature. So what is it not effective in South Africa needs to be tested in the next time. We won't know that immediately. And some of the chemical companies have already started with those trials. What was confirmed was that those trials are not effective. But there's still some other, like carbines, that may not be effective for this illustration of the effects. So what we do have is what farmers access to. Also, we don't, there was a question about the competition of pesticide companies. We only register active ingredients, and we only register based on companies applying for emergency registration. In other words, we've invited on our side all the companies, and from CropLife itself, they've invited all the companies to register for emergency registration, meaning that as it is active ingredients registered, it means that there's more than one company supplying a specific active ingredient for this, making the availability much easier for a lot of costs as well. Do I need to wrap up?
Thank you very much for responding to the questions. You know, before I give you another member at that time to ask questions, you must know that we are eating our own land. No one will be here before we finish the meal. It's very tough work. So, if we proceed, no one will leave until we are done the minute. Agreed? Thank you very much. I'm going to allow you to discuss as long as we keep our own life. The issue of controlling of pipes, I thought it was raised by one of them. I didn't hear it because there is this tendency of if there is an emergency, the issue of price becomes a problem. Particularly if government will start to say we are coming in to assist in mitigating the situation, then the issues of the price. Because as I understand, when you were responding, you say pesticides that have been utilized are the same ones that have been used before. So the issue of the price doesn't come in when you have now people start speaking up the prices because government will come in. I didn't get it clear on that one. Thank you. The second issue, which has raised and which was not responded quite clear, from my understanding, how did it arise here in Africa? Because it's most important whether our management control is it effective. You know, now I can understand why. I get irritated when I in the flight before you leave, they spray something very dangerous. So that they say they are killing flies, but usually they spray it when it leaves here. When you come from these European countries, they are not spraying it. So how do we relate? Because obviously it can be the back of somebody here. If it cannot, if there is no evidence that it can fly over the water, it might be brought by the back of somebody.
those countries. So the issue of the control in that in those areas. The content that I was saying, when you come from, most of the flights that came from Africa come at around 5 o'clock at the airport. And our officials start to work at 8 o'clock. Who's monitoring in that process? So I'm just saying the control itself, if we can just get clarity in those areas, because the issue that we've raised is very critical and important. How did this arrive to Africa? And with again small border farmers, even when we use the drought resistant maize that was produced to export all chemicals to deal with this thing, the small border farmers were not going to be affected directly by this. But because we have produced a drought resistant maize, not utilized by any body, maybe ARC will confirm whether it has been utilized. Now the small water farmer will be affected, and we must put another money to save them. I think we should actually be very, I don't want to say responsible, but cautious of what we do as government to maximize the work with the little resources that we have to our. To assist our smallholders. Honorable members, Honorable Maloy and Honorable Sultana, Honorable Phil, Honorable Nabi, and Honorable Erekulu. So, co-chairs of lunch, yes, Honorable Maloy.
No, thank you, Chair. I'll be very short despite the fact that I don't eat lunch. There is one thing that confuses me just a little bit. You are saying this pesticides were used before. And on slide 12, you are saying in South Africa they've been registered according to emergency registration procedure. And my understanding of why I'm sick is that they were not registered before, but they were used. That's what you are saying. I'm not sure exactly what I'm saying. So if you can just clarify me on that, I'll be very happy. The African armyworm, we all know that it was harmful to livestock. Is this one harmful to the livestock or not? You know, some 4 or 3 years ago, when we were attacked by this African armyworm, many of our livestock died, and so on. Is this also harmful or not? If you can clarify that one, and if it is harmful, are we doing something about it? What measures did you put in place to ensure that if our cows, our goats, our sheep consume this this thing, it is something that we can give in order to ensure that they don't die? The last question, which I think you are not just answering properly, Minister, and this one is to yourself in particular. Smallholder farmers. You know, today I was listening to one farmer, and that farmer is a commercial farmer, it's not just a smallholder farmer, who was saying these chemicals are extremely expensive. A commercial farmer, that's what he was saying. And it is attacking your Limpopo, Northwest, and so on and so forth. And I can tell you from where we are sitting, the people who are mostly affected are smallholder farmers. Is there some emergency fund somewhere? Because see, the minister says we are going to look at the money that we did not use in CASP and so on and so forth. That thing is happening today. Are we doing something today to assist the smallholder farmers to address this particular problem? Because if we don't do, by the time we intervene after the 70s, I'm not sure, you said the meeting is on the 70s,
after the 17th and so on, they would have been affected badly. And it would be a step backward. But what are we doing today and yesterday to attend to this problem which is existing now? Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, thank
my
you, sir. Dealing with the issues of socioeconomic impacts. One would love to know if they have already done any exercise by way of calculating the potential impact on food prices because of the suddenly increased input costs. Secondly, the food availability factor is always critical in South Africa. How are we going to address that issue if basic stuff like wheat, maize, you know, are potential hosts of this, because that will eat directly into what people say a lot of, majority of South Africans eat and depend on a daily basis. What measures have you taken, you know, to obviate that? And lastly, have you started running campaigns, you know, with the farmers who do not rely on the radio and TV to get to know? You've got Minister of Food Soldiers, you know, and which areas have you, you know, just broadly speaking in terms of provinces, where have campaigns, informative campaigns, started being done to make sure that those people are aware of what's happening, of what's coming, and how they can deal with the problem? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Firstly, I'm not overly happy with the response from the Minister on, you know, looking at lots of diseases coming from Africa. I know it's the role of the department, but I think this one specifically was kind of a clear indication. Even before registering things, the only thing that I'm concerned is, why didn't we put any surveillance in place, or at least warn people to look out? I've heard that some farmers saw it already in December in crops, that there was something different. And if at least we've started putting something in place without being alarmist, what is the right English word? I'm not happy to share with that. I think we need to beef up on what, you know, just at least surveillance of pests. There's a lot of other pests that I'm also aware of. I've heard the other day that we can't export tomatoes to Mozambique about some of other tomatoes. So there's a lot of things happening. I agree with that. But my problem is that I don't think we have the capacity, money-wise and people-wise and training-wise. And we need to beef up on that, Chair. I think we need to have a look at it when we discuss budgets and annual performance plans so that we look at it. I've asked questions in the past about only two surveillances being done in a year, and it's because of cost. We don't have the money for that. So, Chairperson, the question that I wanted to ask is again on the cost, whether a cost analysis was done. Because we saw that the list of the areas in six provinces, which we already know and it's confirmed, can anyone tell us the area that is already affected or infected, and what the cost would be if we start talking to Treasury? Because we can't go to Treasury and tell them, you know, we actually don't know how much money is involved. So someone can tell us if there's some kind of cost analysis or stuff.
Thank you, Chair. The first one is related to what one of the farmers is saying. This, the one of assisting the poor rural farmers. First is that to them, when they have only 1 hectare and 2 hectares, to them that is equivalent to 100 hectares of a commercial farm. But I also know that when they control the pest, they are able to put a drop of medicine on each and every plant, and to them that is achievable. And that's a lot. So for it means to me that if they can be assisted, I want to have some access is going to happen there. And therefore, to me, that is linked with the two now, that while I believe that there's only one capacity that department can talk to us about. That is the finance one. I believe that all the other capacity they have, it's a matter of coordinating and efficient use of that. And therefore, bring that to the chair.
Thank you, Chair. I think the point I want to just raise touches part of Maroy has just raised. I was just looking at the pressure side, the influence on our local grades, you know, and I think these are some of the shares that are in by grades. Are the grades not going to be affected or die if these levels after spray? Firstly, secondly, Chairperson, the general concern that I have, the department or government seems to be reactive most of the time on issues that are affecting the country. I'm raising this, Chairperson, looking at the challenge of the invasive plants that have been brought to South Africa, which have eaten the fields for our livestock. The grass is no longer growing under those foreign plants like cromelin and others. Recently, we've experienced some sort of native plants that grow with quite thousands of them. As well, it has eaten up grass, which is good for our livestock to feed on. Those are the challenges, Chairperson, that I want to raise. Because seemingly, each and every moment we're faced with something, then the government department will jump on what is happening. With a few years back, there were some lizards, small lizards, that used to loiter in the house rather than being outside the houses, which have taken place for our ordinary survival lizards that are found loitering in the yards and outside the homestead. I don't know the name of these creatures. I used to call them hoppers. You know, they are found inside. They eat most of the time flies inside the houses. So that's why I'm saying, Chairperson, seemingly we seem not to be very productive in dealing with whatever that is being brought in from other countries. We have filled the bed. They were not there when we were still young. Today, we are seeing them taking the place of our local base. And they are very destructive. If you follow them, you'll find that if an ordinary bird of South Africa or Africa, if it's nesting, they're going to destroy the eggs before they even their hatch. You know, that's what I was just raising. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson, honorable members. I will start with the question by honorable Maloyi on the whether there is any funding. When I spoke, I did say that the POPO has set aside plus minus 8 million as a step to assist, as from now, smallholder farmers that have come forward and identified whose maize can still be saved. But what on the 17th, the aim is to see and the discussions with Treasury, because before you can utilize funds, you have to get their concurrence and also try to find any more funding. I agree with you 100%. We have seen yesterday where we went to farms of commercial farmers vis-a-vis smallholder farmers. You cannot miss the capabilities, the different abilities, machinery and financial ways that is, they were able to respond when they were these pesticides were registered. Let me try to do what is not mine, to deal with the issue of registration. You may have a pesticide, let's take for instance a stock borer. It is registered for a particular worm. If another worm invades and yet you have not yet registered that
particular person had to be used for that. Then because even the producers would put prescriptions as to how it should be used. That's the reason why we have immediately when you identify which worm it was, we have to register or ask for people to give us pesticides for registration, because before they were registered, I don't think we could have allowed their usage if they were not registered. They were there, but for other other pests. And I take note of which we answered earlier of this, that says sometimes as government we don't react promptly. And I repeat to say, I think we need to improve the regional network so that we know what happens when and we share information. I think it's where there has been a weakness. As I'm saying, through FAO we are being coordinated now. All the information we will develop from this test, we will have to share with other African countries, not only its presence, but also the methods of control and the rest. The other question was to invasive plants and how we react. Maybe it is more to do with the issue of overlapping duties in government. When you deal with invasive plants and species, that falls under the Department of Rural Affairs. We work with them in dealing with that. That will also include the trees like that grows mostly in other parts of the country. That does the damage, creating problems and causing soil erosion. We're working on that, and it is informed by what has been defined in the recent climate change conference in Paris. That has outlined what should be done. Maybe we need to take this back to that coordinating committee that is led by Minister Mlewa, so that we begin then to do more work. Yes, I agree, funding will have to be found very quickly, because if we are to assist small-scale farmers, we need to make sure that we plan for that. And one of the issues that I think we need to clarify is that as to why we did not inform farmers earlier when it could have been maybe seen as reckless to say to farmers, there's a worm that is attacking us. We don't know what it is. We don't know which pesticide to use. Because people would use any pesticide that some of them may leave residue that causes problems to people beyond. We have to make sure that our scientists work very hard to find its biology, how it and what it is first, and what chemicals to use. Maybe if we would have done earlier, as you say, Honorable State, that when it was picked up in Nigeria and other places, and I repeat to say, had we have a very clear coordination in the continent, I'm sure most of these pests could have been identified. But if, I think, Honorable members were to visit our ARC house on pest control, you would be amazed to find how many pests have been scientifically checked, what mechanisms have been used, and what is happening. I'm sure it is a question of dealing with them. Even the one on potatoes, also on tomatoes, we are aware of. There are many, the one on bananas, I mean, there are many pests who are delayed. I'm not trying to say the reason we did not act on time on this one is because of the workload. But workload, yes, is part of what we're dealing with. Whether that is due to controls, I can tell you, one thing I have been complaining of has been that we're lax with our laws. If you are in Australia, you're from one province, and you carry an apple, you are made to pay severely. But at home, if you are found with an apple, when you're from overseas, it is just taken. It's one of the things I think we need to look at in terms of control, that we are not punitive as a country. Because if you are found with any agricultural material, those dogs will sniff your bag and it is taken away.
And those dogs are paid for by the department, by the way. We spend money to make our people available in airports. Those are kind of things I need to improve on, how to make sure that we promote. And I'm sure this Act on Border Control Act may also be where we need to put more emphasis in trying to find. And I can only say I appreciate the work that our scientists have put up with other scientists from the University of Northwest, the other stakeholders. But it does not change the fact that some farmers have been affected. And I can promise that we'll do our best to make sure that we use all the language radios. Maybe one would say farmers are not always listening to a radio. But we will do whatever we can do, whatever methods we'll find to make sure that we spread, that farmers must make sure first that when they detect this, whether they can cause problems or health hazards to animals, I think I cannot venture into that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. And maybe this is the opportune time to also introduce to honorable members the importance of legislation that passes through Parliament. Because one of those that is coming in terms of preventing the Agricultural Pest Act of 1983 is the Plant Health Bill or the Phytosanitary Bill that is on the way. It makes provision for what Minister had highlighted to say what are the penalties that you can bring in to ensure that people are deterred from bringing in agricultural products that might be of risk to the country. So that's one of the issues that we were looking at. And the Honorable Singh asked a question around the capacity of government to respond to the potential hazards that you are having everywhere. I think let me first commend the committee in terms of the DRRR that there was money that accrued to the department within this unit and through this committee, so that we are now able to go on to the next phase of procuring a system that will ensure that as you go through the increase, your products are registered, so you cannot use any other product to deal with it. But in essence, if you look at surveillance and quarantine, we still have got requirements. I think the last request that we had with National Treasury was just to deal with early warning systems or pre-border issues, border issues and quarantine issues. We needed 278 million to deal with that. We hope that we get this money, and we know that they are competing needs, but the aspect like this outbreak makes it very important for us to start looking at this aspect that are there. But we as a department, we appreciate the input that was made by this committee in terms of the people for us, and we have seen that money flowing in. Now, the cost analysis that we have done previously, and I would like to also couch it to say this is a fluid situation. It changes from day to day. When we make our estimations, we are working on 59 million rand. Based on the reports that we will be having, we will then interact with Treasury based on that. But we had already made this cost at 59. But with the current reports that you are getting, it means that you have us to build those costs up towards a particular level. There was a question that was asked about how did the pest arrive in South Africa. I'll give that to Dr. Price. He will also deal with the element that would this also be harmful to animals, as asked by Honorable Malloy. Those will be dealt with. And I think that Minister has touched on other areas that I thought were of importance. The issues that were raised by Honorable Fultani on how do we look at the analysis that we are having. You will be aware, for all the crops that we are having, we have got the crop estimates that we do that. Now, we have got an outbreak that is there. We need to factor in of what impact has it been in terms of our crop estimates. So there is a mechanism that is there, but all that we need to build in is what are the fractions that we have got to build up to deal with the crop estimates, and we will discuss with the crop estimates just to factor this in. On whether it will impact on the food prices, it's a question of either or, because we still have got to see what's the extent in terms of this and whether it will go into the food prices. But because you actually making an impact in terms of your variable costing, in terms of the operation, it will then need to find reflection in terms of the cost that is there. But how big that element in terms of the fraction still needs to be worked out. I think those were the two questions. When I wrote the Bekulu, the issues around the invasives that we are having in the country is a very complex issue. And it goes to two things. If you look at globalization, it means that commodities and people can travel faster over long distances. And with them, they carry aspects that would need to be looked at and regulated from agriculture, from environment, and others. And therefore, your early warning systems, your border control measures, and your early detections, if you have got this exotic in your country, become very important. And this is where the element that I just highlighted, to say you need a whole system, and that system, you still need to convince that you need money in order for us to run that system. But we are aware, and we're dealing with this aspect from a regional basis and other countries. We are looking at those countries, even countries like Australia and New Zealand, that are islands, are also even having these incursions from now and then. So you suddenly realize the importance of the regional approach in terms of dealing with pests, diseases, and other exotics from an environmental point of view. But it's something that is being looked at from all departments that are there in government. I would then give over to Dr. Price to look at the issue around how did the pest arrive, and also deal with the issue that Honorable Maloui had raised, whether this would be also affect animals. Thank you, Chair.
The issue of how this worm got into Africa is probably quite complex. We don't actually know. The prevailing winds go from east to west across that part of the tropics, because we all know that dust from the Sahara on the Hamasan winds gets blown into the Amazon, so, and hurricanes go from right to left across the Atlantic. So the general prevailing wind is against the migration into West Africa. I'm not saying it could not have happened, but no evidence whatsoever that species get blown from the Americas to West Africa. It's the other way around. That's the prevailing wind village. In West Africa, for a number of years now, there's been quarantine interceptions of fall armyworm, not on refined dry maize, but on green mealies and bulk wet sorghum and things like this. So it's been intercepted on a number of occasions. So it seems that it's become established, but it could have become established decades ago, because the sudden upsurge and extent of this outbreak is we can't understand how it can happen so quickly. So a lot of pests get into a country and sit there for many years, such as the pom-pom weed in Pretoria. It sat at the Fort Trekker Monument for about a decade and hardly moved, and then it goes into an exponential growth phase when it starts to spread rapidly. So the pest biology, the invasion pest biology, there's a whole science about this, shows that pests come in to get established, battle to stay established, and once they've overcome that initial phase of getting established, then they can spread. So possibly the same thing has happened with this fall armyworm in West Africa. The spread across Africa was unprecedented. The first publication we saw was in, first report was in in January 2016, so it's only just a year ago that this thing was starting to be picked up in the trial plots at the International Institute for Tropical Agriculture. They picked it up in their trial plots. So this was the first time that there was an indication that something was going on. and then once it spread as a migratory pest, then there's no stopping it. But the biology of, and the dynamics of how it got established in West Africa, we don't really know, but it looks, it would be conceivable that it's been regular imports and things coming in and establishing over many years, probably. A question about the harmful effect when there was grazing by the African armyworm on certain grasses, especially kikuyu grass. The kikuyu grass as a defense mechanism creates cyanide in the grass, which those levels can reach dangerous lethal levels, and there have been reports of stock mortalities. I know in Centurion around Irene there was a number of occasions of stock mortalities on specifically on kikuyu grass, which was grown for fodder crop, and also these people who do this lawns and then cattle grazing the commercial grown lawn grasses. Whether I haven't seen this fall armyworm on pasture grasses yet, but it's just a reaction of herbivory on by the grass to whatever's eating it. So it's likely that could occur again if this particular armyworm eats things like the food. Impact of spraying on wildlife. Now, this is a question which is often raised. If farmers look, the pesticides will have an impact on non-target organisms. But if they're sprayed correctly, at the correct dose rate, at the correct application volume rate, those impacts are limited. But if there's a tendency to spray double the dose to kill the thing quickly or to really drench the maize crop, then it will have an impact, and especially on the applicators, the people spraying it, if they're not particularly properly protected. And there's a danger of, if they do overdose, that there will be residue build-ups that will be unacceptable. But our message to the farming community was to specifically be very careful about following the rules and don't spray just because you think this thing must die quickly. You must prevent the residue build-up. The proactive response to the enforcement of regulations. South Africa's got excellent legislation, the CARA Act, the NEMBA, which was newly promulgated a couple of years ago. That's excellent legislation. It's been many, many years of politics and research inputs. It's excellent. But to implement it, to police it, the invasive species, there's a whole list of plants that shouldn't be sold. If you go to any nursery and you can pick out cactus plants that shouldn't be there and are being sold. So it's a matter of just too difficult to police. You go to the Karoo and even the municipalities are planting invasive cacti in their traffic circles, which these things spread. A lot of the cactus species that have become invasive have been planted in homesteads which became abandoned or on municipal land. So self-inflicted wound that generations later they have to sort out. So the message was that we have the legislation, we have the research capacity, the knowledge, but there's a definite shortage of funding for to implement that and to police it.
I can maybe just add on the impact of different type of pests in the world. Part of what we do is to monitor pests occurring and spreading in the world. And there's quite a number of pests already in Africa, other continents, which we are monitoring. And as referred to citrus greening, which is an Asian strain of citrus greening. And that's particularly a worrying pest. And we've been busy monitoring this for a couple of years now for entering, because it can enter in various ways into South Africa. But now it has been found in Ethiopia that the vector, the insect that's spreading it, has been found now also in Tanzania. So the disease is not in Tanzania and the insect is not in Ethiopia. So it's just a matter of time for Harry to meet Sally, and then it's a major trouble. And the reason why I'm saying that is that this particular disease came into Brazil and in Florida, and in Brazil it has wiped out more citrus trees than we have. In other words, it has the potential to wipe our whole industry out. Those are the type of major pests we are looking at. There's maize necrotic disease, which is an also maize disease which is already in Tanzania. Before we have action groups, a lot of research going into that, trying to protect our country, all that. A major impact in Kenya and Tanzania. These things happen. Then there's a bulk of injuries. We've talked about Dutoxin, Dutoxin, and about Trossard or Solas in the past, which is other pests that came into South Africa. But the tendency that we see is that once a pest has entered the African continent, it is spreading quicker and quicker by the decades. And one of the possible reasons for that, and I'm not saying this is a reason for four omnivores is losing wings, but for other pests, is Africa is developing, which is a good thing. But it also means that trade and travel is developing, and it's quicker to travel from East to West Africa or West to East Africa, and from in the southern direction from West to Southern Africa. It wasn't possible years ago. Now it's possible, and there's airplane traffic, etc. Those are the things we need to look at. But even that doesn't prevent these type of things entirely. So therefore, all countries have got policies on that. That's why countries need to report new pests happening on the International Farm Protection Convention or directly to trading partners. So that, then it's official, then you can make a very dedicated response to that. And those are the type of measures we've put in place. The trouble is as South Africa has grown in the last 22 years, was exponential in terms of trade and travel as well. So these things come in. More and more and more are coming in as people are entering the country. And as the minister said, those are the type of things we need to look at, how to detect it earlier and how to find these things in a better way. We desperately want to export our products from South Africa. Then we can earn capital for South Africa. We also want to develop our agriculture in South Africa. But if these things come into the country, it also limits our exports. In certain extent, we have to be cautious on that. That's a very valuable asset that we need to protect.
Thank you very much for the response. The more you answer, the more you raise alarm. And I get worried. The more they respond, the more they see that they're raising a lot of issues. Actually, they might raise questions until they the good thing that we suggested the African on January 22, I expected you to raise a flag from that point. I think you have to raise the important element that how people need to look at this is a big news, and if you remember at some point when you didn't have a job, you raised this news. After the drought, you have a new entering, a lot of challenges. And
every step in your partner's life, but it should really be seen. Because as when I asked them, told you the process is within the forest due to climate change. It's affecting the entire country. It should be elevated. And if you are watching a fowl, for instance, there are lots of resources that are in place to assist countries to manage such climate challenges in the country. So I think we have to elevate and start to look at how we manage it. And we want to emphasize the issue of communication to provinces. Prime Minister Dominic, but I think it is important to, for the extension officer to do a workshop around this issue. And them going, because they are working directly from and they should actually educate the regional water farmers. Because some of them, they might not report them as because they've not heard about it. You know, those small water farmers. So they just need to be educated and we have to build our capacity of extension officers for them to be able to communicate a message like after this discussion and how the information goes to farmers and the response besides waiting for the long queue. And Honorable Kappa has raised the issue of a number where the people can call and suggest I think we should look at those issues. And because Minister, I think because there is no new creation or new development of any pesticide, I think we should send in the sense of our people that they should not be, even if the demand would be very high, there should not be any increase of prices like we see in other sectors. You know, in construction or in the area, everything was built up, the cement and everything that has to go into building of area, everything goes up. Even now, you know, the market used any opportunity. If government starts to announce that we are putting money to assist farmers on this issue tomorrow the price goes up. And before you can make any announcement of money management, call these people because they are registered with you and tell them we are announcing this thing because we want to assist, not for you to reap government money. They should work with you to deal to control the situation, not to be part of government money without any benefit. I think that's something that we have to look at. And thank you very much. I think we have been empowered as a committee what we are doing, and we want to appreciate the excellent work that you are doing. And we know that you are doing this on constrained resources, Minister, and we'll continue to work with you until the police department is funded such that it will respond to the major challenges of having food security in the country, dealing with management of the business, both of plants and animals, because that is very critical for us to be able to secure our nation with food security. Thank you very much, Minister, and your team. For your release, Minister.
very much.